summer, and fall. Let me give you just a few examples of lawful, nonviolent, resistant actions that are being carried out right now by local groups across the country. Here in Boston, a Boston Ice Tea Party is being organized to dump ice into the Boston Harbor to protest Trump's attacks on immigrants. Other examples include witnessing and filming mass roundups, organizing neighborhood watches and immigrant assistance groups, boycotting companies and banks that contract with ICE, boycotting media companies that give in to authoritarian pressure to cancel speakers like Jimmy Kimmel based on the content of their speech. And then there are examples of courageous individuals who are resisting both at the national and the grassroots level. Former military members of Congress filming a video reminding officers and troops of their duty not to obey illegal and unconstitutional orders. A high school baseball coach in Harlem stopping government agents from randomly interrogating his players. Parents patrolling schoolyards in D.C. to protect students and other parents in raids by ICE agents. University presidents refusing to sign Trump's compact conditioning federal funding on a university's giving up academic freedom. Journalists reporting on National Guard troops in Chicago, Portland, D.C., and Los Angeles, despite threats to them and their families. Now, resistance can succeed.
You're listening to John Shattuck on Resistance. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Resistance can succeed. Research by my Kennedy School colleague Erica Chenoweth shows that when 3.5% of a country's population is mobilized for continuous protest activity, the resistance begins to work. Recent international examples are Brazil, where a broad-based and well-organized opposition defeated an authoritarian president just 2 years ago, who then tried to overturn the election by attacking the capital and was convicted this year of attempting a coup. Poland, where a coalition of pro-democracy opposition parties organized a record-breaking voter turnout in 2023 to defeat an authoritarian regime that was following parts of the Orbán playbook. Guatemala, where an anti-corruption candidate last year was elected president and successfully resisted several coup attempts. And Bangladesh, where democratic reforms are now underway following the defeat of an authoritarian government. So resistance is not easy. It takes time, discipline, a willingness to take risks, and close attention to the specific circumstances of a country facing internal authoritarian attack. In the U.S., this means having a mobilization strategy that operates simultaneously on two levels. First, defending the electoral process and winning elections like the ones last month and the midterms next year. And second, equally important, resisting by organizing non-cooperation and persuading prominent people in the mainstream pillars of society to stop trying to appease the dictator. Authoritarians accumulate their power by planning and implementing detailed strategies for weakening democratic institutions. Trump's Project 2025 is a blueprint for this in the U.S. It's the product of years of close coordination among far-right think tanks headed by the Heritage Foundation and constant contact with authoritarian leaders like Viktor Orban. Sophisticated far-right planning creates a major challenge for the resistance. So here are six guidelines for what must be done to overcome this challenge. First, resistance movements must avoid what we might call circular firing squads and getting mired in their own internal disputes. Building a coalition to resist an authoritarian requires a shared goal and a commitment to set aside differences so they don't get in the way of achieving the goal. The perfect should not be allowed to become the enemy of the good. An internal disagreement, for example, over whether to end a government shutdown shouldn't be allowed to get in the way of spotlighting the authoritarian's actions that caused the shutdown in the first place. The importance of putting aside differences is well illustrated by the growing resistance movement, yes, to Orbán in Hungary. This year, for the first time in 15 years, a broad coalition of Hungarian opposition groups has come together around a single unifying candidate who is now polling ahead of Orbán for next year's presidential election. A second rule is that resistance movements must avoid stagnation. Resistance can get trapped in cycles of mobilization without achieving change. Movements that rely exclusively on social media, organizing, and street protests are often unable to sustain their momentum when an authoritarian steps up repression. To be successful, a movement has to build a durable base at the local and state level and deploy a full range of nonviolent tactics to challenge the regime and encourage its supporters to defect. For example, witnessing and publicizing the violent roundups of immigrant workers and their families, which is being done now by thousands of local groups of Indivisible, is clearly contributing to the growing public opposition to ICE roundups, as have lawsuits challenging these actions and community efforts to support the affected families. Third, resistance movements must have a positive message beyond anti-authoritarianism. Authoritarians claim legitimacy by appealing to the public demand to make things work. In response, the resistance must develop a credible message and policies about fixing things that aren't working, for example, by delivering affordability, as the winning candidates did in last month's elections. The movement must call for effective reforms and not simply defend a broken system where it was once democratic. Fourth, the resistance must control its narrative and fight disinformation by constantly innovating in a changing media environment. Authoritarians today seek to control the media in order to crowd out and contradict resistance messages. To be successful, the resistance must develop new media strategies and methods of communication in order to control the narrative of democratic change. This is what Mamdani and Newsom did in this year's elections campaign, and this is how the funny animal costumes from Portland that went viral in the October protests completely undercut the authoritarian narrative that the resistance was turning violent. Fifth, the resistance must engage people across differences and avoid creating its own silos. Ultimately, the most important challenge for the resistance is to reach beyond self-selecting activists to engage people across their political differences. Demonstrations are essential for energizing the base, to be sure, but demonstrations can polarize and push people away who might otherwise be persuaded to join. This means having a respectful conversation and creating trust beyond the protest megaphone and outside of the protest. Finally, and above all, the resistance must respond to the populist demand for fundamental reform. History shows that populist movements can become engines of democratic transformation. It's crucial to listen to populist voices, to understand their disaffection, their grievances, and their demands, and to respond by projecting a vision and policies for a fairer democratic system that gives people the power to shape and adapt to change. Last summer, in a local resistance meeting that we organized for Indivisible, a volunteer fireman stood up and told our group that Trump is asking some of the right questions, but his answers are all wrong. The ultimate task of the resistance is to respond to the questions and to give better answers. After Martin Luther King, two of the greatest resistors of our time were Václav Havel and Nelson Mandela. After their long, courageous struggles against great odds, they achieved what had seemed impossible, taking down communist dictatorship and racist apartheid. They were each asked how they did it. Havel's answer was modest and straightforward. He said, "We did what we could, and when we did what we found we could do a little more. So we did a little more." Mandela's answer was searingly direct. "It always seemed impossible until it was done." 6 decades ago, in a speech in South Africa, the original Robert Kennedy described the ultimate power of resistance in extraordinary words you may have heard, but are worth repeating now. "Each time a person stands up, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression." So, that's what the people can do today. Thank you.
I'm curious how your level of optimism has evolved.
I wrote a book in 2022. 2022 was a time of some degree of optimism. There was a whole lot of polling that was being done about the way in which American values were really being endorsed by at least 60% or thereabouts of the population. Then along came Donald Trump. So, you know, if you want to do a graph of my optimism, it certainly slipped down at that particular point. And I think the crisis that we're in now is a much deeper and longer range one. It's not something that's just a question of this particular person or even this particular regime. However, my optimism began to be restored when I discovered an organization called Indivisible and also several other organizations, that are grassroots organizations, Public Citizen, 5051, et cetera. And these are people who are really working day in and day out to implement the values that polls were showing even in 2022, and I referred to them in my remarks, you know, 60 to 70% of Americans still supported basic propositions like the right to vote, equal rights for at least on the basis of race, as well as gender, as well as LGBTQ. All of those polled quite well. And when Indivisible began to organize and all of these activities began to emerge around the country, I realized this was not Hungary. I had been in Hungary, and Hungary was really captured by Viktor Orban. It was a young democracy, to be sure. It had just really started after the end of the Cold War. And so there weren't any deep roots of democracy, but there was almost no real civil society. And so Orban has succeeded in Hungary in the way that I do not believe Trump or any of the other elements of his regime will succeed in America, because I think the depth of our civil society, represented at by these grassroots organizations that I mentioned now, is really quite remarkable. And I don't think it has receded as a result of what's going on. The one cautionary word, which I will say to myself as I assess my levels of optimism, is that we are very naive. I tried to say that remark in my speech. We've never had experience like this. Unlike virtually all the other countries, certainly the countries of Eastern Europe, which have gone through fascism and communist authoritarianism over the last 75 years, we haven't had that experience, and therefore, a lot of Americans are really asleep still, or those that aren't asleep are saying that we ought to be able to get along with this regime that we're in now. I think I'm increasingly of the view that the civil society doesn't believe that, there, and that's what Indivisible is all about. So I think if we wake up and come to understand some of the things that I was describing here, and including the roots of it that go way out into Europe and are not simply some blip that happened here in the United States, then I think we can be optimistic. I do not think the future belongs to this kind of regime in the United States.
So I wonder, what are your thoughts where if we're faced with a regime that's basically going to ignore laws and constitutions and rule by military force, what are your thoughts on how a resistance can overcome a power that relies so predominantly on physical military force?
Well, I'll give you a short answer. Certainly, we are not at the stage of authoritarianism whereby it's entirely military force that is holding it together. You're right, not yet. No, I'm not saying it couldn't happen. I think Václav Havel and the other great dissidents and leaders, Sakharov and others, of the resistance against the Soviet regime and all of the satellite countries organized. They had to do everything secretly. There was a lot of jeopardy that they were in. Fear was rampant in the population. People were not willing to participate in the resistance because they were fearful of what would happen to them. So it becomes that much more difficult. The public has got to really understand that the issues of deployment of military, particularly National Guard troops, from states other than the ones in which they're being deployed, is probably the single most dangerous authoritarian action that's going on today. And we need to take as much action as we can to resist that. There's litigation that's being conducted. Some litigation has been successful in D.C. in pushing back. The spotlight needs to be shown on this. And frankly, I think the six members of Congress, former military members of Congress, who have just done the video urging people in military positions not to follow illegal orders is exactly the kind of thing that we need more of. And I was glad to see these members stand up, and I think they need to be supported, and they are being. I think they're getting a lot of attention. So there's no easy answer to what you do if there's a full-scale military occupation and nothing it can move other than by virtue of, being allowed to cross the military, which you can't do.
First, why do you think the majority of the Supreme Court has been so deferential and compliant? And second, is there a tipping point that might change that? And third, what might that tipping point be?
Let's go to the third part of your question first, because it answers all three of them. The Supreme Court has yet to be directly defied. It also hasn't directly ruled against Trump, as I said. So in a sense, it's untested. I think the tipping point, I would hope, is if Trump refuses to follow an order of the Supreme Court that goes to the basic exercise of his authority. The same way, for example, when President Nixon was ordered by a vote of 8-0 of the Supreme Court to turn over all of his tapes, had he defied that order, that would have been a tipping point. I think, obviously, he didn't defy the order, and it was 8-0 against him, and then they proceeded to impeachment. Anyway, why is the court where it is? A lot of it has to do with effective political court packing, which has occurred. Look at the way in which Amy Coney Barrett got onto the court at the very last minute, sneaking through because she was being promoted not only by the administration in the last administration before Biden, but also by the Senate Republicans. Anyway, there's a whole lot of politics around that. There's also doctrine, which is the doctrine of originalism, which is another very dangerous doctrine that's being bruited about in the Supreme Court, which is that basically that you have to follow exactly what it was that the Constitution meant at the time that it was adopted, and no way in which it can be effectively looked at in the context of the contemporary society. Anyway, that's another reason why the court is backed up. But the most important question is, what will they do if they're defied?
Okay. Given the current political climate, as a young person who's essentially had my formative years under Trump, being stuck in between really different sorts of extremism and, you know, loss of faith in democracy in itself, how can I restore my faith in a way in democracy? You know, like, how can I convince people who don't believe it that democracy is worth saving?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think you can actually enter into a dialogue with them. What exactly is it? I mean, it's not the theory of democracy, but it's many of the institutions that are broken. And in that sense, as I said in my talk, we need to listen and process what these critiques are. Democracy is not simply defending the Congress because it's, you know, been captured by Trump and therefore it needs to be recaptured, or defending any other institution that's otherwise, you know, broken in various fundamental ways, which is causing people to resist on the other side, resist democracy and turn it down. How can you restore your faith? I think you can restore your faith by trying to understand what fundamental changes are needed to, after all, bring back something that is so fundamental. Democracy, at least in theory, is about taking control of your own life and having some involvement in decisions that are being made about you. That is what democracy is. In the old, certainly, you know, town meeting days, that may have been possible. Anyway, how can we rebuild it? And I, you know, take that as your own task. That doesn't mean you're going to rebuild it, but you're going to try to figure out what reforms you think are necessary.
We often speak about defeating Trump and authoritarianism by existing democratic institutions and practices. But the question that I have is it really possible? The Supreme Court is governed by a conservative supermajority, which just now has cleared the way for Texas lawmakers to use the gerrymandered maps in the next midterms. Republicans' gerrymandered maps deny voter protection and voter rights, and it becomes increasingly harder and harder to believe that it is possible to defeat the Republican Party by the ballot. And even if Trump or Vance or any other Republican contender is gone by 2029, the Republican Party and all these institutions, they will remain. Fox News will remain. The media empire that fuels this hatred will remain. So is it really possible by democratic peaceful means to defeat Republicans?
Gerrymandering is a tricky business. I agree with you that it's a power grab, no question about it, and that's certainly what the Republicans are trying to do. However, gerrymandered districts become more difficult to defend by Republicans. What's just happened, I think, in Tennessee, I believe this was a gerrymandered district, which was overwhelmingly pro-Trump. The Democratic candidate now did much better, partly as a result of everything that's going on that we've been talking about, but I believe also partly as a result of the gerrymander, which meant that there were more Democrats in that district who had been spread out to accommodate the gerrymander. So that this is not a defense of gerrymandering, but it's an answer to your question. It's not inevitable by any means that even with a total and successful gerrymander, which I don't think will occur, I think there are plenty of resistance going on. Some states are resisting doing it. You probably saw Indiana, for example, I believe Kansas, and then also Democrats are doing it in response. So it's a kind of a stupid and dangerous, kind of war of tactics. But I don't think it's necessarily going to lead to a long-term success for the Republicans. Quite the opposite. I think it may actually be their undoing.
Walmart has a plan to essentially challenge the tariff regime in the administration. If I had to guess, there's probably not a great amount of sympathy for Walmart in this room, but it seems to me somewhat remarkable and somewhat perhaps even hopeful that an organization like them can take on the regime in this way. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Okay, just a very quick answer. I think it's an example of the complexity of these pillars that I was talking about in my remarks. The pillars are not holding up the regime, even though they seem to be friendly to the regime, and this is a pillar where Walmart is a major part of the business community, you know, is now doing something that is contrary to the interests of the regime. I commend Walmart in this respect. There are other aspects of it that are problematic, but this is exactly what we need to develop a more effective resistance.
The Democratic Party is wildly unpopular. Do you think that there needs to be a transformation of the Democratic Party that involves removing its current leadership, that doesn't speak to the many issues that really are driving this rise in populism and the rise in authoritarianism?
I think there needs to be a total revision and rebirth of the Democratic Party, and there is actually developing at the local level. I think the Democratic Party is, depending on where you are, it is going to reflect the politics and the opportunities of the candidates who are being put forward. Mamdani is not the same as the new governors-elect of Virginia and New Jersey, et cetera. To the extent that the Democratic Party tries to put a straitjacket on itself across the country, which is what it had done in the past and certainly was doing in the latest election, 2024, I think to a large extent, it's very ineffective and very unpopular. However, to the extent that the Democratic Party can emerge from the grassroots, just as the indivisible grassroots organization is emerging from all these localities, then I think it can succeed in the old-fashioned let a thousand flowers bloom. That's the way opposition can be developing. It needs to be a big tent with no circular firing squads. Bix a terrible metaphor, but I'll leave it at that.
That's a great place to end. Thank you, Ambassador.
You were just listening to John Shattuck on resistance. He gave the Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture at Boston University in December. John Shattuck is President Emeritus of the Central European University and Professor of the Practice in Diplomacy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Aviva Chomsky, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, John Shattuck on Resistance, and for the classic Howard Zinn books, Original Zinn and A People's History of the United States, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. We can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Martin Folker. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases. From any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.